It was 15 years ago this autumn that investment bank Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy, kicking off a catastrophic chain of events that would lead to the Great Recession, austerity, and the European debt crisis. But 2 years earlier, economist Ann Pettifer had warned of an incoming detonation in her book, The Coming First World Debt Crisis, and called for a political strategy to lower household debt in the global north. But her warnings went unheeded. Anne's in the middle of an illustrious career. She co-founded the successful Jubilee 2000 debt campaign, where $100 billion of third world debt was cancelled by world leaders. She went on. She was part of a small group of economists and environmentalists who, in 2008, authored the Green New Deal to make the financial system the servant of society, prosecuting green objectives. It's a program that's been backed by Al Gore, Nobel laureates in economics, and dozens of politicians around the world. Of course, there have been critics, Donald Trump being the most high profile. But in a world where we've normalized the richest 1% of the world, accounting for over 15% of cumulative emissions, will Anne's warnings go unheeded again? Well, welcome to the We Society, Anne. It's a great pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Will. It's good to be here.
We're going to plunge into the heartland of your work in a moment or two, but let's hear a little bit about you, the woman. I mean, you grew up in apartheid South Africa.
Yes, I grew up in a very small gold mining town in what could be described as the outback of South Africa, the Orange Free State. And my parents went there after the war because South Africa was had been knackered by the 1930s depression, and there was no work, and my dad found work in the Free State because they discovered gold there in 1945, 46, Anglo-American, that is. And there was a sort of gold rush, and he was part of it. Anyway, so I grew up in this really, at the time, quite remote and still quite remote place.
So you were a child of a gold rush.
Yeah, yes. In my little town, first of all, I lived in a place called Windalsriss, and then I moved to a place called Welkom. And it had a reputation for having the highest birth rate in the country, the highest death rate, and the highest alcohol consumption rate. So it was really a rough old place full of, you know, gold rush types.
Now, how did you get from there to here? And where did interest in international finance come from?
So actually, when I thought about it, I think the seeds were sown there because I was quite young when we first went there, but I was 18 when I left. And while I was growing up, of course, we were digging gold out of in Welkom. And when I say we, I mean mainly black miners owned by Anglo-American. And the gold price never changed once through all that period, of course, because until 1973. And that was because, of course, the deal that had been made in the 1930s by Roosevelt to fix the price at $33 an ounce. And I remember vividly my dad taking me into school, and I would sit in the back of the car and lean over and ask him questions about it. He'd not finished school, never mind going to university. But, you know, I'd say to him, now, why does the price of gold not change, but all the other prices are changing? And he tried to talk to me about something called the Bretton Woods system, or about, because he read the newspapers and he knew a fair amount about that. And I had no idea what he was talking about. But I was aware of this huge contradiction between this fantastic asset that was being excavated in our town and these great mounds of rock that were growing all around the town as the gold was pulled out, but that the price stayed fixed for all that period. And then suddenly in 1973, it was liberalized, if you like, and the gold price went through the roof. And by that time, I'd left home, but then what happened was people started sifting through the rock to get the tiny bits of gold that people had not bothered about before in order to blah. So, I think
that... So where were you in 73 when the Bretton Woods system collapsed? I mean, where were you physically and what were you doing intellectually? I mean, there's the Ann Pettifer, Green New Dealer,
yeah.
Jubilee 2000 campaigner. How did you come to be that person?
First of all, by that time I was in Britain. I had got involved in student politics at university, but I kind of, I got into trouble, and I had the sense that if I wasn't careful, I was going to end up in Robben Island, on Robben Island. And honestly, I was too cowardly to do that. And I thought, no, I want to get out. By that time, I'd become incredibly disillusioned with South Africa. But, you know, my university education.
Because of apartheid?
Because of apartheid, because I knew black. I mean, I belonged to the only mixed race organization on campus, which was the Anglican Students Federation. The National Union of Students had been banned. There was no other place you could meet black people. And of course, it was a bit of a shock to me because I'd grown up in an all-white community. But when the shock registered, I remember feeling this was so utterly outrageous and against everything I'd been taught from the Bible and so on. Anyway, I wanted to leave. And so I got involved in student demonstrations and so on. But I then said to my parents I wanted out, really, and I wanted to go to Britain because, you know, I'd read English novels and so on, and I'd loved to go there. And I did. I raised some money. I worked hard, and I paid for the flight, and I came over here. I also had a boyfriend here, so that
always
helped.
Always helps. Yeah, it helps, yeah.
It does help. Yeah, so I was here at the time. So what I always had was this background in Africa. You know, Africa was where my roots are. And then I spent time in Tanzania. What happened was I wanted to go back to Africa.
So you've kind of seen, I guess, you've seen the, I'm going to call it kind of unfairness of the relationship between the less developed global South.
Yes.
And the developed global North. I mean, you've kind of lived that.
It's deep in my bones, really, you know, because I came to Britain, thought, no, this is not right. I must go back to Africa, but I didn't want to go back to South Africa. So my husband and I went back to Tanzania, and we were there for when Julius Nyerere was still president. And that had a huge impact on my psyche, as you can imagine, was the end of the Vietnam War. And seeing the Vietnam War through the lens of a small, poor country in Africa was fascinating. It just changed everything that I, all my thinking, really.
Let's talk about debt. Let's talk about, let's get going. And we'll start off with the Jubilee 2000 campaign.
Yes.
I mean, that was, what roused you? And what do you think was the trigger moment that led to the kind of debt alleviation program following through?
I was following the debt crisis and reading books about it at that stage, you know, and
We probably should start off to the uninitiated by actually saying what it was.
So this is the sovereign debt crisis that had, if you like, emerged on the margins of the global economy in countries like African countries, but also Latin American countries and so on. And it had arisen, many argued, as a result of the oil crisis of the early 1970s, when actually, you know, there were too many dollars being earned in the north. And a lot of those were dumped in the south to avoid inflation. That's the traditional argument. And so money, easy money, was lent on to all kinds of governments in the South. And was the argument is that was part of the process.
There had been a succession of crises before this. I mean, a number of countries got themselves into trouble. Argentina, I remember, a Latin American debt crisis. Yeah. And actually nobody kind of blew the whistle and the system would carry on. And ultimately you had a whole bunch of countries having insupportable levels of dollar debt.
Well, the history of Brazil and the history of Argentina is the history of debt, essentially. You know, they borrowed money to build the railroads and so on, and they borrowed money then from the City of London. So, yes, there have been rolling sovereign debt crises over decades, over centuries.
Well, let's start with the debt crisis in 2000.
Yeah.
The Jubilee campaign, which kind of you were really in the middle of, to persuade the West to write off debts to large parts of the global South, Africa, kind of Latin America. Why that moment?
I think, you know, the sovereign debt crisis for poor countries had been building in the 1970s, 80s and 90s. And by the 90s, it was pretty serious. They were, if you like, diverting more of their resources to repaying debt to rich creditors than they were towards their own economies. And we became aware of this. We became aware that actually, and you know, they had to pay in US dollars. You can't repay if you're Zambia or Tanzania or South Africa or Nigeria, you can't repay in your own currency.
Yeah, got to find the greenback.
So which means you've got to earn dollars, and which means you've got to orient your economy towards exports and so on. And this was basically, you know, damaging, naturally damaging those. And we argued it wasn't sustainable, and rich countries didn't have to, if you like, milk poor countries of those debt repayments. And indeed, the IMF made sure that they were always replenished with new money. And when we argued with the IMF about this, they said, well, don't worry, we just give them more loans. We'll just offer them more loans with which to repay off old loans so that we keep the creditors happy, essentially. And we argued this is really not sustainable. And but as there's no international framework for the resolution of debt crises in the same way as there is at a domestic level, you know, we have bankruptcy law, insolvency laws at home. And, you know, this prevents creditors, if you like, from putting debtors in jail or grabbing all of their assets and so on. There is no such framework in the international sphere. It's a very unbalanced, unfair framework. The creditors are dominant and, you know, they call the shots. And basically what we said was that we've had enough of this and our government, the British government, shouldn't do that. And then we aligned with others in the West and built this Jubilee 2000 global movement and pressured our governments to say you don't need to keep bleeding these countries of money which they can't afford and you surely can afford to lose. You know, it was a hell of a fight. But in the end, we persuaded Gordon Brown, Tony Blair, and Clinton, I mind you, only after the Pope had put enormous pressure on them all, to write off for the poorest countries. Now, they didn't write it all off, but they wrote off a substantial amount, $100 billion in nominal terms for about 30 countries. And that is actually peanuts in the global economy, but it meant a lot there.
At the time, yeah, we thought, fantastic. And it was fantastic.
Yeah.
But here we are, kind of 20 years on, and actually the problems continue. And Africa's more populous and
yeah,
you worry about how the 21st century is going to unfold.
Sure. So we began with a simple demand, cancel the debt by the year 2000. That was our demand. And that was very attractive and attracted an awful lot of support. But as the campaign progressed, it became very clear to me that it's no good writing off the debt if you don't change the system, if you don't somehow change the structural imbalance between rich country creditors and poor country debtors.
I just want to take a moment to talk to you very briefly about the organisation behind the We Society. The Academy of Social Sciences is a national body for academics, practitioners and learned societies in the social sciences. As the president of the Academy, I can tell you that we champion the vital role social sciences play in education, in government, in business, the list goes on. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences work, support us, or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. Tell us what we should be covering, who we should be speaking to by emailing wesociety@acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. There were fears only 10 years ago that global temperatures would rise by 4.5 degrees by the end of this. Now it looks as though the figure's going to be, it's still too high, but I mean, it's going to be, you know, hopefully lower than 2.5. And that's a big deal to achieve that. I mean,
Yeah, I'm worried about if it hits 1.5.
Yeah, I know. But countries around the world are taking it seriously. And there's a movement to kind of decarbonisation, which is accelerating, and growth of renewable energy. And you yourself, I mean, one of the group that got the Green New Deal off the ground, Anne.
Yes.
You must be quite pleased.
To be honest, by nature, I'm an optimist. And I believe we can do something about this. But I think also there's a great deal of ignorance and a great deal of obfuscation around the economy. And I don't think it's accidental. Plus, there's some pretty bad economics out there. You know, one of our problems. I won't go into the economics profession that keep us going for a long time.
Because you're not a professional economist, are
no,
you?
No, I'm not, and I have no pretension. I am a professional economist, but I'm not an academic economist.
Not an academic economist, yeah.
And I have no pretensions to be so. I mean, my work has arisen out of my experience, out of my lived experience, especially working on sovereign debt. I mean, it was a very privileged position to be working on that because I worked with some very effective and wonderful economists at the IMF and the World Bank. I had, you know, I spent those 5 years really deep in the whole.
Who was paying you? Where did the salary come from?
Well, I was, the Jubilee 2000 was set up on the one hand by a very wealthy man and backed by all the big NGOs, Oxfam, Christian Aid and so on. And they employed me. They put an advertisement in The Economist and asked if...
You know, you answered it. Hey, Pastor, here you are, sitting in the We Society studio 20 years later. Do you think that there's enough momentum behind the kind of environmental and green concerns? I mean, the fear is that there's a certain amount of green fatigue.
Yes.
And that people will make so many sacrifices, but no more. And that actually some of the support and momentum for this may be fading.
Yes. I mean, I think people are still a little complacent, and we in Britain are particularly complacent. We've been protected this summer by the jet stream. If we'd been in Spain or in parts of Europe, you know, and had a crop or had a business that relied on water and so on, we would be feeling differently. In Libya, now Libya is, I was thinking how interesting it was. It wasn't climate change that caused 10,000 people to die. It was the fact that there were two dams on their big river that had not been maintained or looked after, that burst and flooded the nearby towns. And, of course, the rain and the heavy rain and so on played a part. But the really big part was the infrastructure and the fact that, of course, because of, for all sorts of reasons, that country has not had a government, but above all, that dams, which are fundamental to stability and resilience, we are allowed to weaken. And so in this crisis, boom, two dams burst and 10,000 people die. So, you know, what it's taught us is that, I mean, I think it's about 10,000, people are estimating 10,000, that actually we need to invest in the infrastructure that we need, and Africa needs to invest in infrastructure that it needs to survive these coming threats. And they are very real threats. They're not coming. They're there already. You know, people are already impacted very seriously by climate breakdown. I think we're a little bit complacent here because we think we've got time. I'm not at all sure that we have all that time.
Where would you start? We must bring this to an end because we. Yes. I just wanted to kind of... But where would you start? I mean, you want to go to Bretton Woods 2? Is that the idea? I mean, a Bretton Woods 2, a Jubilee 2000, now we might call it Jubilee 2030 or something.
Yeah.
Really, you know, push for the Green New Deal 2. I mean, these three areas is where you might move. I'm just trying to pull your thoughts together. And where can listeners to this who want to follow up or kind of play a part in change? What can they best do?
Well, I think the first thing we have to remind ourselves is that just a few years ago, was it 2-3 years ago, we effectively nationalized capitalism. You know, we nationalized the economy because of COVID. You know, and what was extraordinary about COVID, and I, you know, like you, I was here, I've watched as people obediently stayed at home, obediently gave up all kinds of things, obediently did not go and visit their parents in hospitals and so on. And they did that without any real enforcement. There was a huge transformation took place. And people willingly and understandingly said, right, we've got to do this because this is a crisis. So we are capable of reacting very quickly and making big changes overnight. And our government even turned out to be capable of doing that. Now, you know, it was costly. It was hugely costly for many people. But nevertheless, what it shows me is that actually we can very quickly bring about a transformation. And in this case, it was forced on us. But I would hope that we can do it willingly. So, you know, I would say, yes, we have to transform our system as it is at the moment. That's the theme of my Substack, system change. We have to change the system. And we can do that.
Okay. This is the roundup, the last couple of minutes.
Yes.
I'm sure you're right. I'm sure that there is the possibility of people behaving collectively in their own interests. But actually, what concretely do you want them to rally around? What is your agenda for action? What do you want elevator pitch, 1, 2, 3.
The first thing I want to say is that we invented money in order, as Keynes argues, for us to be able to do what we can do. We can do this. Money was always something that would make that possible, would make it, you know, accessible. But our money system has been captured. You know, it's no longer there for us to use. It's there for actually just a minority to use. So number one, the first thing I would do would say I want to subordinate, we must subordinate the finance sector to the interests of society. And that requires regulation. And there are very quick ways we can do that. We can set terms and conditions for the use of all our public services, the Bank of England, you know, our criminal justice system for where the finance sector enforces its contracts, and so on and so forth. The government bonds that we issue, which they use as collateral in the shadow banking system. These are all things we can say, you're very welcome to use these public resources, but these are the terms and conditions. We could do that tomorrow.
Okay, that's the first thing. The second thing is?
The second thing is we have to understand that the climate crisis is so real. And, you know, I've got grandchildren. We can't mess around with that. You know, we have to change our habits. We have to give up on fossil fuels. And I'm so proud of being part of the Scottish Government's Just Transition Commission. And I'm, you know, my experience of being on that commission is to understand how hard it is, for Scottish oil rig workers to give up what they're doing.
The Scottish Just Transition Commission is...
It's a commission for preparing for a transition to a greener economy, if you like, one that is not fossil fuel dependent. But because Scotland is so dependent on Aberdeen and North Sea oil, this is a dramatic and bold move by the Scottish Government, and I'm part of that. And every day I learn about how very difficult it is. But where there's a will, I mean, at least the Scottish Government is beginning to prepare for this change. The British Government has still not yet done that. So that would be another thing we could do. The third thing I really want is for women in particular to get a grip on economics, really. It's not rocket science. I want you to understand the way the system is working, because once you do, you'll see how easy it is to change.
You make this important distinction between not being an academic economist, but being a professional, practical economist. Mm. You know, in what sense would you call yourself a social scientist? I'm hoping you think social science bridges the practical and the academic.
I think so, absolutely. Also, social sciences implies that economics is not, you know, a science. It's part of the social sciences, and therefore it's much broader. And it includes the other social sciences. I mean, economics always has done, but it's in the last few decades, it's narrowed itself down to sort of mathematical economics, or if you like, economics which is supposedly scientific, when actually it isn't. It's a social science, and if I may say so, it's highly political. So I think it's really important that we should see ourselves as a social science.
Anne, thank you enormously. It's been a really intriguing conversation. We've really, from your childhood in a mining district in South Africa, through alternating between First World Britain and the Global South, living at first hand the injustices and inequalities between the two, you have chosen to intervene in the best way you can. Your passion about alleviating debt and the success in doing that, your participation in the Green New Deal project, and that had cascade effects, of course. It was picked up and didn't go far here, but it got picked up in the United States in the 2017-2018 and run with, and arguably Joe Biden is doing some of those ideas that seemed so off the wall back in the day. And your ongoing concern at the heart of all of this to put finance at the servant of society, and to do that as a self-professed and proud social scientist. It's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Will. It's been an honour. Thank you very much.
The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences. Find out more about the Society by going to www.acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast so you're the first to know when a new episode comes out.